Politics Smash, Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Kent Fielding. Kent Fielding is the author of a new collection of poetry entitled River Church, Selected Poems 1990 to 2025. Kent Fielding lives in the small town of Skagway, Alaska. How are you doing, Kent?
Doing great. Thank you.
It has great to see you again. We were younger a long time ago. but I want to begin. We were talking before we were on the air. Talk about Skagway, Alaska, and how you wound up living there.
So Skagway, Alaska is a small town. You know, it's about 100 miles north of Juneau, top of the Panhandle. Population in the winter is about 700. It is one of the 15th top cruise ships destinations in the world. So the summer is really busy with tourists. It's kind of how the town makes its living. But I think I wound up here. I was teaching at UAS in Mount Edgecombe in Sitka. And then I got a job out in the Marshall Islands, and I was out in the Marshall Islands for a while. And then my wife was just, we had a birth of our first child, and my wife was, just wanted to get back to Alaska. And so, that's kind of how you get back. I just started looking for jobs and ended up back in Skagway. I mean, I had some other offers in Alaska, but I think Southeast was where we wanted to be. And so I'd been to Skagway before, and I ended up back here. I was, thinking when I first came back to Skagway, we'd probably be here for 4 years and then go somewhere else. But we've been here for longer than that. Kind of when you start a family, that's kind of what happens.
Right. We've heard so much about the impact of various cuts to, especially affecting radio. What's happening in terms of Alaska? Because that was in the news in terms of concern.
Well, so, as far as cuts to public broadcasting, we have one radio station that serves both Haines, Skagway, and Kwakwaketa, Alaska, and I'm pretty good friends with some of the local people who run the radio station, and I'm told that we have 2 years left. They think they have 2 years of funding, and once that's, if the radio station disappears, we have nothing. I mean, there's, silence.
When you say nothing, I mean, what's that? Would it be picked up by print or something like that?
Well, I mean, we do have a local newspaper that's published, once every 2 weeks, but it's also owned right now by someone outside of Skagway. So, I don't know exactly what they're covering. Silence.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll talk about that a little later on. But let's go back to when we first met, and I believe we were a student at the University of Louisville. Right. But I want you to begin our program, since you have a new book out. Could you read the poem Kent, named Kent, that you have?
Sure, yeah. This is named Kent. Think of cigarettes. Your father named you after his favorite brand. My uncle chuckles, sipping wild turkey. My father, a chronic smoker, smoked 9 packs during my mother's labor. The story? He stood staring at a pack, Kent 100s, when the nurse brought the news, a boy. Think of cigarettes. Think of my father, the white lobby, his pacing, stick after stick in his mouth. Smoke curling from his lips like rough ocean waves on a foggy morning. Think of cigarettes. Think of me, named after his favorite brand. I became the smoke that made my father cough, the smoke that blackened lungs, the smoke that filled the long work hours at a school he hated. Inhale, inhale. To buy bread, to buy shoes. We were poor. We needed so many things. Pencils, pants, doctor visits, dental work, electricity, heat, milk, love. I am the smoke-filled days, the orange flare as he inhaled. My growth and deeds became stubs that looked like tombstones in the ashtray. I got in fights at school with kids older, gave one 10 stitches, threw rocks at cars, nicking and denting two or three. I stole candy from stores, peed on my second grade teacher's Datsun, hid in the woods to avoid the principal and a whipping. Still, my father came, reliable, stern, again and again he came to get me from the office, cigarette smoke in the corner of his mouth, gray smoke drifting into his graying hair. Again and again, he inhaled, asked, "What were you thinking?" I think of the cigarettes in his hands, chalk sticks to mist one's name. Our lives are the inhale of burning particles. Our lives are the release of gray truths. When I die, let it be with smoke and fire. Let the consumption be brief. Think of cigarettes. Think of my father working into the night, grading papers, shaking his head, missing sleep so that I could eat, so that he could protect me, so that I could grow and learn. Think of the smoke in his lungs, the smoke that ate his life.
Listening to Kent Fielding reading from his book, River Church, Selective Poems, 1990 to 2025. Thank you for that reading, Kent. So let's go back to when you were a student at the University of Louisville. You were putting out this Thinker Review. I thought that somebody had gave you like a whole bunch of money that you could do anything you wanted to do. That's a rumor I heard. So take us back to what I think it was around 1992, I think.
Yeah, it was 1992. Yeah, I was hired by the University of Louisville to edit that magazine, and it's sort of been in non-existent for a while. And so they hired me. The actual day was February 4th, 1992. A writer by the name of Leon Driscoll hired Ron Whitehead and I to sort of edit that, and so we took over, and they gave us. I mean, there was some money there, but they gave us this ability to do whatever we wanted, and we kind of did. Yeah, and so we released a couple journals. One was a double, and then we also released an anthology of contemporary Louisville women poets as well under Thinker Review. And then we went our own way and created what became Whitefields Press and the Literary Renaissance, and which published, chapbooks, broadsides, posters, and did literary events all over.
Well, talk about that first meeting between you and Ron. I mean, where was Ron from?
Ron was from a place called Ohio County, Kentucky, which is really tobacco. I mean, really not tobacco. It's really a mining town. I mean, it's coal mining. His father was a coal miner. That's where he was from. And we, met. He was, I did not know him until we met. And he was studying Joyce, James Joyce, and doing some, writing on James Joyce. And I mean, that was his direction. The first meeting was really interesting and intense. I mean, we were there was four people hired. Two of them decided not to actually accept a position. And so Ron and I got this meeting to this Thinker Review office, which was in the top of the old Student Center at University of Louisville, which had no windows, just four walls. And so it was, you turn out the lights and it was pitch black. And I think on the first night or the first week, one thing that we did, we talked about trying to create a sort of literary movement in Louisville, and Ron really wanted to create a literary movement in the entire world.
In the entire world, right?
Yeah, and Ron was asked. We wanted to create a reading program. Bring some writers in that we as sort of younger people wanted to hear, because. Universities, they bring in academic poets, and academic poets are great, but we also wanted to bring in some people some beat writers that we were interested in.
But then how did I get invited? How did you guys hear about me? Was it a fifth round draft pick or something like that?
No, I mean it's. Yeah, you were one of the writers I was interested in. Carmen Embry was introduced me to your writing, and I was one of the things that I really enjoyed about your writing at the time was that there was a lot you had written that book of protest poems.
Where the love poems are dictated.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was like the first book of yours that was introduced to, and I was really, you know, that's one of the things that Ron and I were really interested in, is like, you know, protest poems, you know, you know, so that was you have to start somewhere. That was the connection. But I mean, at that first week, you know, one thing that we did, which I thought was kind of, looking back on it, kind of strange, but I guess at the time made sense, is that we wanted to start this, you know, literary movement and bring in writers. And we called, you know, Allen Ginsberg up. I had one of those old poets and writers directory books. And Ginsberg.
Right. One of those things that he had to write. Exactly. I remember those.
Yeah, and Ginsberg's number was in it, so we just called him up, you know, out of the blue, and somehow we got hold of Bob Rosenthal, who was Ginsberg's, manager at the time, but Ginsberg was actually in the office, and so we set up a reading with him, you know, because he'd never been to Louisville. He's like, yeah, sure, I'll come, you know, on the first week, which is like, it sounds bizarre these days, but because you got to go through all the different channels to get somewhere.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, you know, I went back and I pulled this little you had this Heaven Chat Book series, and I looked at this, okay, and I don't know how many you did. There's seven here that's listed. One was W. Loran Smith, The Boy Became a Book. Second is Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Travels in American Deserter. Three is Allen Ginsberg, On Visiting Father and Friends. Then Dying the Primer, The Mask is the Path of the Star. Fifth is Amiri Baraka, Tom S. Clarence. That's what seems very timely today.
Right.
Number six was me with The Fire This Time. And then seven was Ron Whitehead and yourself, The Revolution is About to Begin. And you know, these are nicely done. There were 50 copies of each, you know. But, you know, what happens is that when you look at this type of work today, which is like hand-stitched and everything, if writers were getting together like you and Ron today, it would be something like online publication.
Right.
Do you feel that something's lost in terms of just the whole aesthetic and the whole thing, a process of putting up together like a chapbook?
Yeah, no, I think the chapbooks and something that you can put in your hand, I think, is, you know, for me is you have a sort of a, I don't want to say an artifact, but like, you know, something that, you know, you can take hold of and you can show off to your friends without saying, hey, here's a link to, you know, my poem online. And I also like, it's harder for me to read stuff online, and it just might be our generation. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I would prefer to have, you know, something in front of me in print. You know, and the thing is like, you know, I don't, you know, something I can mark up, you know, physically. And you'd be amazed at some of those older publications that, like, I sometimes search them online, see what they're going for on eBay, and some of them are a lot of money.
Well, you know, when I think of what you guys were doing, I go back and I think about Dudley Randall, who started Broadside Press, first doing broadsides. Yeah. And I think when I look at the broadsides that you guys have done, I mean, you want to frame these things, you know, I mean, they're very attractive. Talk about the whole thing of collaborating with like other artists.
Well, I think that, you know, as far, I think the thing with broadsides and what I love about broadsides is you can, like, there's so much possibility, because you have the, you know, the print, the words themselves, which is great. But beyond that, you can, you know, add photography or artwork, and, you know, that sort of, so it's a, you know, when you frame them, a combination of, like, you know, different, you know, art mediums, you know, you got the poem, you got perhaps a you know, a painting or a photo. It just, you know, on a wall, it just brings it out and, you know, attracts the attention to the viewer. And you can also analyze, if you wanted to analyze the poem and the painting and see how they relate to one another. Mm-hmm. It's there's, you know, there's a lot going on with it, and I do have a, you know, a lot of those posters framed, and I have both your posters framed and on my wall. So yeah, it's
you know, when you think about that, you know, I want you to talk more about Ron and yourself in terms of when you go back and look at the 50, look at the Beat Poets, you know, they were doing these type of things, you know, running the small magazines. You know, I think of Hetty Cohn and Dinah Premer and Leroy Jones at that time doing these publications. At that one time, it was like mimeographing stuff. I'm reading like Anne Waldman right now, you know. And so, I really feel that you guys, you and Ron, you know, kept a tradition alive.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we took our lead from, you know, from the Beats, particularly like, you know, Dinah Prima with her like mimeographed, you know, just the idea of getting that work out. I think it's important, getting, you know, being able to like, you know, promote something that you thought was important, that you thought other people should read and try to circulate it and get into as many hands as possible. I think that, you know, when you talk about poetry, I think that's really important. And maybe that's what's going on with online stuff, but it seems like something is lost. I was really impressed with like Dinah Prima, like, you know, selling like a first edition of Howl, you know, signed edition from Howl by Allen Ginsberg, to just continue publishing, you know, this stuff that she was doing. It was also fun. I mean, you know, you're young and you have a lot of energy and you can get out and do a bunch of stuff. And, you know, the combination of the chapbook or the publication plus the live events, you know.
When you look back at this movement, you know, you mentioned Diane quite a bit. You know, I remember at one time, you know, even her name sort of like was in the background, you know. Right. And are there any... Well, two questions. One, who are the Beat Poets that you like? And then also, are there a number of Beat Poets, for example, that are not well known?
Yeah, well, the Beat Poets are like, I mean, Dinah Prima is definitely up there. I mean, Revolutionary Letters, I think, is just one of those books that you need to, like, everyone needs to read. It's the idea of, you know, what she did with that book and the things that she fought for in that book, you know, both with, you know, the art. I mean, it's a book that I also find like a lot of younger female, poets are attracted to as well. So I think, you know, for at least the immediate future, I think her position in literature is secure. But the other one that, you know, other Beat Poet, and he may not want to be named a Beat Poet, I don't know, is Mary Baraka. I mean, Mary Baraka is like, you know...
Well, he first published him and Hetty at that time. Yeah. They published Ginsberg, I think, for the first time.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, but like, you know, Mary Baraka, like, you know, is like another name that I think is very, you know, very secure just for the volume of stuff he did. But like, you know, poems like Thomas Clarence, as you said, is timely. It's like, yeah, I mean, it's like, I make that joke all the time. Like, first time I heard, you know, Mary Baraka read, he read that poem and he said, yeah, some people are so backward today, you got to turn their name around.
Right. Well, you also had the thing to turn their evil backwards is to live, which is another play on the word. And I always liked that one. When we think about this period, you know, I'm looking at how more attention wound up being given to like Bob Kaufman, it was that. And then it seems as if when we look at this period, it's also East and West Coast.
Right.
You know, now I wonder, I mean, you're looking here, looking very angelic. Were you ever also influenced by like, say, Buddhism or Zen or anything like that?
I wasn't really interested. I mean, I wasn't ever really influenced deeply by Buddhism. I did, you know, read some Buddhism, you know, when I was like, you know, studying, you know, Ginsberg and Kerouac, knowing that they got into it just to try to figure out what they were doing. But, you know, and it never really, you know, stuck. I mean, I still, you know, meditate every once in a while, but it's meditating really just to clear my mind. And
so you got into drugs and stuff.
Yeah, you try to, you know, at my age, you try to, you know, you those things are way in the past.
that's why we have this show, that we can document who you are, Ken Fielding. What this is all about. But let's go move on to some things. I wanted you to read another poem because it gets into you as a writer. And I wonder if you could read Stealing Time, because I think a number of people would identify with that who are struggling to write.
Find it real quick.
It's on page 7.
Thanks. I took my marker out. I did have it marked. All right, stealing time. Stealing time. You must make the time to write. Steal it from somewhere. From employers who believe they own the minutes of your life. Silently say, these are my moments, and write. Write lines during the day as you answer the phone. Teach students. Wait on tables. Lay concrete. Record it. Write it. You own your seconds, no matter how much someone pays you. Write during sleep. Dream poetry and get up in the night to protect the words. Write during chores. Turn that grocery list into a poem. Tomatoes, carrots, and the yolk of the moon scrambled into daylight. Make your life yours again. Stay away from people who want to own you or who need your attention, who need your gossip, your time, your energy, who want to sell you something. Write a I'm done with you poem. Start it, dear so and so. Look for the worms in the earth. Smell the earth. I am of the earth. I am the earth.
And feeling, reading from River Church. You know, I'm listening to you. This could probably be made into a poster because, you know, it sort of explains, you know, you go into an MFA program and this is on the wall there of your teacher.
Right.
But, you know, I'm thinking about this and I want you to move into talking about, I guess like around 1995, you went into the MFA program at University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Yeah.
Talk about that experience in terms of what encouraged you to go to an MFA program. How did you select the MFA program that you wanted to be in? Was there a particular person there?
Well, there was a couple things. You know, in 1995, Ron and I had, we had been busy like every single day doing, you know, literary stuff for three plus years at that time, and so I decided, it was time for us to do something else. You know, Ron went to Iceland and I was looking for an MFA program, but I also wanted to go somewhere far away from Louisville, you know, to get a different experience, and Alaska seemed like the place to go to. It just, the wilderness and I hate to say it, the cold it seemed like something I wanted to experience. I also had, was reading John Haynes at the time, and John Haynes is, of course, something that, attracts a lot of people, So that seemed like the place. And I even like someone like Douglas Brinkley encouraged me to go to Alaska because he's like, there's outside of John Haynes, there's not a lot of poets in Alaska. You should go.
That's so, right. I remember you had this, when you met Doug Brinkley, you had the New Orleans connection.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Right. You mentioned John Haynes, and I think that's a good place to, when we talk about Alaska literature. I remember sitting on a NEA panel. We were giving out these awards and stuff, so like lifetime achievement type things. And so, we're in DC, and John Haynes' name comes up, along with like Adrian Rishkin and Brooks, people like that,
Right.
And nobody like, who's John Haynes? and I said, that was my lesson in terms of how, and you can comment on this, Kent Feeling, about how sometimes regional, like, okay, I'm in Kentucky and I just know the Kentucky writers, or I'm in the South and I know the South. That what, and maybe New York and New Jersey dominates the literary scene, So talk about that in terms of, John Haynes' work and how important that is to understanding Alaska.
Yeah, I mean, John Haynes for the longest time was sort of the Alaskan voice. He has been reevaluated. I think, there's a good friend of mine, Nicole Stellan O'Donnell, who is a poet up in Fairbanks right now. She teaches at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and does stuff with the Arts Council up there. In her recent book, she has a section on John Haynes where, she calls John Haynes out as, perhaps being sexist and maybe racist, white male in Alaska in a time where, he was the voice, but I think there's perhaps other voices that are coming out of Alaska now. But Yeah, he you know, he does sort of capture that sort of homesteader like feeling, I think, of the 40s and 50s of Alaska that, that did attract a lot of, you know, a lot of people to Alaska, but maybe at the expense of the indigenous population, you know, those voices that are not heard as well and should be heard more. I think, you know, that's one thing that's, you know, happening in Alaska, that, you know, the rediscovery and reemergence of voices that, you know, that should be heard, that indigenous population that, you know, that, you know, in, I don't know what you want to call it, imperialism or
sort of took over. We'll find a word for it. Okay. You know, when my time in Alaska, the person who brought me up to Alaska was Peggy Shoemaker.
Yeah. Peggy was my MFA advisor. So yeah,
I know Peggy. Oh, okay. So, and then with some other people like that who were in that department, I recall.
John, what is John's name? John Morgan.
Okay. And what did you focus on at any particular person at that time? Okay, you're in an MFA program. Are you studying or writing? Like, okay, I'm going to do a thesis on this person.
I was writing. Yeah, no, there was a lot of different writers that I was looking at that would influence me at the time. But, you know, Gene Valentine was a big one.
Okay.
You know, Neruda, Valero, Lorca, you know, some of these, like, you know, writers that really dealt with the, you know, surrealism or, you know, magical realism. Those were the type of the writers that I was, like, really looking at the moment. Michael Burkhart, you know, Michael Burkhart and Gene Valentine worked a lot with dreams, you know, and dream imagery, and those those types of things influenced me. And those were the writers that I was really concentrating on at the time, sort of to get away a little bit from the beat writers. I mean, beat writers still influenced me, but, like, you know, you gotta be well read. You gotta read.
Right. Before we take our break, I'd like you to read one more poem, and you made a reference to surrealism, and there was one poem that I thought really gives us a listener's example of that, the poem The Lover.
Okay, yeah. Okay. The Lover. When I met the girl in the tobacco field, the rain descended with angry insults. It did not like our affair and appeared jealous. The rain did not believe I was her husband. It wanted her for itself. The water beads turned into worms, centipedes, maggots. They crawled in my hair, on my skin, and bit. Thunder rolled like an older and harsher voice. An oak cracked in two. We ran laughing to a barn where we undressed for the rain. Later, my heart became a trout pulled from a deep lake. I felt a knife fillet it for the frying pan. There was a smell of garlic and onion. The olive oil sizzled. A series of kisses from a happy mouth. The flesh smiled as it fried, and there were leftovers for a week. Their girl had never eaten such a fish. She walked home full, and the rain hugged her and called her daughter.
Listening to Kent Fielding reading his poem, The Lover, from this book, River Church. You know, I'm listening to you, and I said, oh, that sounds like Marquez.
Yeah.
And that's a compliment.
Yeah,
we're going to take a little break here, come back and have continue our discussion. My guest this morning is Kent Fielding. He's the author of River Church, Selected Poems 1990-2025. My name is Ethel Brett Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Is your social justice calendar for the week of September 8th, 2025. On Thursday, September 11th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Sankofa Books and Cafe presents Nobody Can Give You Freedom, The Political Life of Malcolm X book discussion with author Professor Kehinde Andrews, located on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more information, visit Sankofa.com. Also on September 11th at 6 p.m., there will be Malcolm Lives, a 20-year anniversary Busboys and Poets presentation at the 14th and B location on 2021 14th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. For more info, visit busboysandpoets.com. On Sunday, September 14th, from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m., the D.C. Peace Team will hold an online session entitled White Supremacy at Work. The session will explore how white supremacist violence functions in professional spaces. Using the framework of The Wizard of Oz, participants will examine how power hides behind performance, fear, and illusion. For more info and to sign up, contact fgortere@dcpeaceteam.org. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Kent Fielding. Kent, why don't you read from your book, River Church, Coffee with Adele.
Okay.
And talk about Adele.
You want me to talk about Adele first or read?
Whatever you want to do. It's your show.
Coffee with Adele. She sips coffee as blue jays land in a nearby tree. My aunt is 102. She does not recognize me, does not remember all the times I turned her mattress, washed her car, brought her the chocolate brownies she is not allowed to eat. But she tells me about her family's farm, the horses, the barn, the cows on the hill, all the chores, how she desperately wanted to escape the country, escape the tobacco hanging in the barn and the smell of manure. She explains what it was like to live through World War II, the cousin who lost his leg at Omaha Beach, how he no longer laughed or smiled, but was quiet, hollow, how she read newspapers, searching for the names of friends killed, missing, searching for her cousin's missing leg, how she moved to the city, waited tables at a diner, how she met her husband, Ted. After Macy's Thanksgiving parade, at a bar, he bought me a drink. He was Irish, a fireman, loved his whiskey, and he could laugh. He could tell a story and always smelled like peppermint. She laughs at the thoughts of him. I'm told that each memory is its own world, formed and reformed every time we create it, as if experienced for the first time, as if imagined for the first time, again and again and again. Who are you? She asks. I forgot your name. And I begin to think about my own aging, disappearing into dates and images of the past, unable to recognize family in the present. What does it mean to be alive but lost, to remember yesterdays but not what happened an hour ago? Will I vividly remember the 1980s, the songs of Michael Jackson, Kurt Cobain's suicide, the first girl who kissed me and who broke my heart, but forget my granddaughter's face? Will my granddaughter sit next to me, a stranger drinking coffee? Will I listen to songbirds, watch the clouds alone?
Kent Fielding reading from his book, River Church. Talk about that poem, because I find that poem doing two things. One, being a caretaker, and also dealing with aging.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, my aunt actually just died this past April. She was 103. Remarkably, you know, she was still, you know, she could walk around and everything, and, you know, remarkable for 103. But yeah, her mind, her memory started to go in the I think when her mid 90s. And I remember, you know, because I live in Alaska, and she was in Kentucky, and so I remember, you know, visiting her, you know, when she was like 95 or 96, and both the great thing and terrible thing that at the same time was that like every 10 minutes she would be like, "Oh, you're here," and her face would light up because she's like, you know, "You come to visit me," but you know, it was like every 10 minutes, and it's like, you know, she'd forgotten that I was there, just, you know. So that was both great, and because it's great to see, you know, someone's light face, like, right, up when they you know, haven't seen you in a while, and they're like, yeah. But it's also like terrible because, oh, I mean, I've been here for an hour.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, and then you start, you know, thinking, you know, and she could tell you about her past, but you start thinking like, you know, your own age and like, mm-hmm. what, you know, that fear, like, you know, will I start to forget people and not recognize their faces and, you know, have to leave myself notes, you know, as far as, you know, because like she did, I mean, there was notes that she had about certain things that she was supposed to remember because you would forget. But yeah, that type of aging, I think, a lot of people, I think, fear.
Hmm. Well, you know, I find it interesting. If you were workshopping this poem, somebody would say, well, why isn't this two poems? One about your aunt and one about you, you know, because, you know, I mean, it is that transition that's there. Yeah. And then I also want to know, I mean, our listeners can't see it, but you change the structure near the end of the poem in terms of how you use white space. And I'm wondering what constantly went into that decision.
Yeah, the ending of the poem, it was a conscious decision just to show the breakup of like the memories, you know, the disconnection of perhaps thoughts that seem to happen, you know, in old age, particularly when you talk about the present. I mean, I think the past is, you know, at least with my Aunt Adele, that the past was secure. I mean, it's like it happened and she could remember it, but the present was always broken up as far as like, as far as like what was right next to her. Hmm. And that was
like, and I like what you said about that, because that shows you exactly how when you're looking at a poem physically on the page, okay, you're very conscious that this is what you're trying to do.
Yeah, and one thing with the poem in the beginning, there's some longer lines, and even on the page that those they're indented, because the line itself didn't fit on the actual page, because the book is fairly, you know, it's kind of small, as you know.
It's one that we call a pocket book.
Right, yeah.
Because for you, a man of travel, this is the type of book that you want to have.
But in your, yeah.
Hey, you know, we're not dealing with the Kindles in it. We're dealing with the pocket book. But, you know, we made a number of references, Kent Fielding, today about Kentucky. Could you read your poem, Kentucky, that's on page 67?
Yes. Okay, so Kentucky. The buzzsaw of cicadas in the trees announces the heat to the tobacco fields, dark green, leaves the color of some South Pacific sea. You expect ships to be buried underneath with lost treasure, Spanish doubloons, Roman coin. Men have drowned in tobacco in this town, searching for it, cut the plants in the rain and caught the sickness. Were sucked under by the shovel's undertow and the preacher's feverish words. They disappeared in thunder. Tobacco fields hold many bones, more than most graveyards, for the living must grow upon the dead.
Thank you, Kent Fielding. You know, we'll go from Kentucky, and because of this poem, it's a good transition for you to talk about how and why you got to the Marshall Islands.
I was actually in Sitka when I got the job from Marshall Islands. I was teaching at a combination of UAS, University of Alaska Southeast, this boarding school, Mount Edgecombe. Mount Edgecombe is a boarding school for, you know, really of the population of Alaska, all over the state, that want to get a better education because of the schools in their communities might be either non-existent or not very good because teachers, you know, just don't stay long. So as I was teaching these two places, and the pay was decent, but I was never going to like move up anywhere as far as like the pay goes, and I was also told by the person who was the head of the UAS teachers, the UAS professors association, that they were looking to cut the position in Sitka. And so, you know, kind of had to look for a new job. So I went to this international job fair because I thought, yeah, teaching international would be great. I was actually looking at a job at the time in Syria, because like, I was like, I thought I was going to get a job offer from from this international school in Syria. I did get a job offer from an international school in Turkey. I may have gotten one from the Netherlands, but the person from the Marshall Islands was really pushing to get me to come there. And I was like, the Marshall Islands, you know, it's the middle of the Pacific, should be a great place to go, right? Like, sun, you know, beaches, you know, ocean. So, but I also learned quite a few things by going there. I mean, it was a great experience.
What did you learn? Because when I think of the Marshall Islands, I just think of nuclear testing.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I really encountered face on is nuclear testing, which I thought was, you know, I didn't know as much about, you know, before I went there. But when I came back, I was an expert because there was a lot going on. I was also, you know, one of the things that was shocking to me was, you know, the extents of it. I mean, I had students who, you know, had 177 cards, which was these cards, which means that their family was affected by nuclear testing. And so they could get, you know, free, you know, treatment at the local hospital over in Ebi. But also, like, you know, I was teaching in Kwajalein, and, you know, the Kwajalein was sort of the American, military installation. And I think the difference between a military installation and a military base is the fact that an installation means that most of the people there are contracted by a, you know, a company. And so, like, most, you know, there was mostly civilians. But the difference between that was it was like Kwajalein was like 1950s. So, like, going back in the 1950s, you know, you have your country club with a golf course, and you have your swimming pools, and you have your perfect lawns, and you have, you know, free housing. And then you go across the bay to this place called Ebi, which is where all the Marshallese lived. And, you know, and Ebi is called the slum of Pacific. I mean, there was at the time over 12,000 people living on less than one, you know, square mile of land, you know, and none of the houses they were all one story. And so, Ebi was also a place that never slept because, like, you know, there's certain households that you had to rotate sleeping because there's just not enough sleeping space. So the difference between the two was kind of shocking for me as far as, like, you know, because of Kwajalein is owned by the Marshallese. It's just rented out by the United States. But, of course, the United States, you know, took Kwajalein during, you know, a battle in World War II and never left. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, rented, you know, but, you know, I can't foresee them actually leaving until climate change floods that island. I began to wonder. And you know, the Marshallese worked all the jobs on Kwajalein that the Americans didn't want to do, you know. Mm-hmm. So I began to wonder if I was working for the wrong people, because like, you know, it's, you know, it you know, it just made me feel wrong, you know.
You know, when we say Marshall, how many islands are we talking about?
Well, okay, so when you talk about the Marshall Islands, there's 29 atolls, you know, and each atoll has many different, like, what's called islets, you know. So Kwajalein is actually the largest coral atoll in the world. I think it's like 125 miles, you know, square miles. I don't know how many islands or islets it has, but it has many. And, you know, Kwajalein is the biggest. Kwajalein is about 3 miles long, and at the widest is about 0.5 mile wide. Mm-hmm. You know, so when I was teaching there, I could, like, you know, stand, and the school was two stories. I could stand on, you know, go out my, you know, room and look to the left and see the lagoon, and look to the right and see the ocean. So these are small islands.
Talk about the indigenous population. If say, for example, young people, are they trying to get off the island? You know, I mean, you know, what is it, heavy drug? What are some of the health situation issues?
Well, I mean, the people are trying to leave the Marshall Islands for better jobs for the most part. I mean, I think Marshall Islands is one of the places in the world where it has a declining population, not because of the birth rate, but because people are leaving to the United States. Because with the, you know, the Compact of Free Association, Marshallese don't need a visa, you know, or even a, you know, to come to America. I don't think they need a passport. They may need a real ID now, but you know, they can come to you know, the United States and get a job. And, like, there are pockets of Marshallese, like there is in Arkansas, There is a big population of Marshallese that are working for Tyson Chicken. And I think, you know, that I think when I say big pocket, I'm thinking, you know, 5 to 10,000 in that one sort of town. Mm-hmm. So, and there's also a big pocket, I think, in Portland, Oregon, or around Portland, Oregon. So, it's a decreasing population.
How does this affect you as a Kent Feeling as a writer? When you go from, like, say, working and teaching in the Marshall Islands, and now you're in Alaska, do you see a connection between the indigenous people in Alaska and indigenous people in Marshall Islands?
Yeah, you do. I mean, it's like they do talk about similar things as far as, like, there is a connection with, like, you know, nuclear testing. You know, you have, like, in you know, northern part of Alaska, there's an indigenous population that is aware of, like, the fact that the United States did some nuclear experience, like underground testing, even like they talked about what Taylor talked about, creating a, you know, landscaping parts of northern Alaska, Project Chariot, with, like, by blowing up bombs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there is you know, a percentage of the population that believe that they were, you know, tested with radiation, plutonium, just to see what, with radioactive chemicals, just to see what the you know, it would do to a local population.
That sounds like the Tuskegee experiments.
Yeah, right. And these are all things that you can, you know, you can research yourself and look up. But, you know, there is that connection. There's also the connection of, like, losing, you know, local culture and this resistance to losing local culture. And as I said, you know, imperialism, and that's you're taking, you know, the idea of taking native lands, forcing, and when I say natives, indigenous people into, like, schools that you know, try to assimilate them into, what would be, you know, white culture, I guess, Western culture. And there's a resistance and an awakening of that, and, you know, that I see going on.
Mm. Talk about how this affects you as a writer, because, you know, you mentioned earlier when we were talking about your time in Louisville that you were very attracted to political work and writing, stuff like that. If I read, like, you know, River Church, it seems to be more family-oriented and personal. But I'm still wondering about whether maybe at this particular point in your life you say, okay, maybe I'll switch the genre, I'll write essays or, you know, nonfiction to deal with the bigger issues that I want to address.
I don't know about, like, essays. I think poetry can address political issues, and I do, you know, I do think there's a couple poems in the River Church that are, like, I would say political poems. But I think, as Mary Baraka once said, that, you know, that you needed a poet on every street corner shouting words of protest or words of freedom or something close to that. And I do think, you know, that can get the message out there. Maybe, you know, essays, but right now it's like, yeah, I think, you know, poetry is where I want to really focus on. But as far as, like, how does this affect me? I mean, it's hard because, you know, both when I talk about the Marshall Islands and I talk about indigenous populations in Alaska, those are, you know, stories that I can't really enter the conversation except for from a white middle-class perspective, which is, you know, cause, like, it's, you know, you people own certain stories. I mean, you got to respect what the stories they own. And it's, you know, and, you know, like, as far as, you know, we go to the Marshall Islands, one poet I would tell you to look up is Kathy Jetnil Kijner, who is a really fantastic, Marshallese poet who does talk about, nuclear testing from a Marshallese standpoint and does talk about, climate change from a Marshallese standpoint. So as far as, like, political poems that, you know, I have on the margins, it is things like climate change and, you know, because climate change is something that's is going to affect Alaska, and opening an ANWR to oil production, you know, is something that will, you know, affect not just, you know, the native culture, but also, you know, everybody else, you know. So those are things that I can, we'll write about.
Right. Well, you know, you're talking about this writing and say, I know that you talk about keeping a dream journal.
Yeah.
Okay. And I was wondering, how important would you recommend that for writers? And
I think keeping dream journal does two things. One,
and define the dream journal just for our listeners.
Yeah, well, so the keeping dream journal is like, you know, you wake up, if you wake up in the middle of the night, you know, write something down. But if you wake up in the morning, try to write down whatever it is that you.
Unless you're rushing to the bathroom.
Try to write it down before you get to the bathroom. But because dreams disappear like that. But I also find like the more you write them down, the longer you're able to, or more of a dream you're able to remember later on, or, you know, when you wake, because it's just like a habit. But those moments are fleeting. But a lot happens in dreams that can be used, like imagery, you know, because I dream in like, you know, vivid images, and that's really important to me. And, you know, sometimes stories as well. I think there's a lot of material there that you could work with if you record it. I mean, I don't think dreams themselves are ever come as full poems, but like they worked into poems.
So do you have like a stack of dream journals over the years?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's
you haven't been sleeping a lot then.
Well, I don't know what normal people sleep anymore, but like, yeah, it's like, you know,
I'm gonna make sure you get tested after being in the Marshall Islands.
Yeah, that's so. I mean, yeah. So yeah, I mean, but also it forces you to write, you know, every day if you, right, or almost every day. If
so, it's a good discipline, is what you're saying.
Yeah, right. It is. Yeah. I mean, because, like, you need a, you know, I hate to say it, for young people, you need to force yourself to write, because, you know, if you just wait for inspiration, it's not going to, it'll come sometimes. It's not going to come, you know, every day.
Right. Well, before we end our show, I want you to talk about one person that I think is, well, I know is important to you. And let's talk about Hunter Thompson.
Hunter Thompson, yeah.
Yeah. Just who he is and why he's important to you, your work, and who you are.
Okay. So Hunter S. Thompson was a, you know, a journalist, gonzo journalism is kind of what he's known for, that comes out of Louisville, Kentucky, which is sort of my hometown, in the, you know, the 60s and 70s, really wrote a lot of activism. Like, you know, he wrote the book Fear and Loathing on this 1972 presidential campaign trail, as well as like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Hell's Angels. Those are three books that he's really known for, and some other things. He becomes known later on in his career more for his personality and his lifestyle than his writing. But, you know, it's really, you know, as far as me, what I am interested in is his writing, particularly, like, you know, those three books, you know, Hell's Angels, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Fear and Loathing, you know, on the presidential campaign, I think are American classics. You know, things that I think everyone should read and think about. I mean, there are, you know, I do realize that some people do not, you know, like him for certain aspects of his writing. But I do think one of the things that, you know, when he was writing and writing well, the critique of American politics was really good.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, let's end on a good note. You know, you're known for these big literary gatherings.
Right. Yeah.
You got one, I think, coming up soon.
Yeah, so the Gonzo Fest, which is a celebration of Hunter S. Thompson's writing and life, and we put writing first, because I don't want anyone to emulate, you know, his lifestyle. I don't think that's healthy.
I know it isn't healthy.
So, I mean, I guess one thing I tell young people, like, you know, do not, you know, you got to look at his writing and focus on his writing, and B, you got, because, like, one thing that Hunter, you know, people don't realize about Hunter is that he spent years developing his writing career before he got lost in, you know, whatever it was he got lost in. I mean, I, you know, we can define it, but also you got to, like, you know, find your own voice. I mean, too many people want to write like Hunter S. Thompson. You can't do that. You're gonna, you know, spend too much time, you know, not sounding like yourself. But yeah, there's, so 2026, we have Gonzo Fest 2026, which is in New York City, which is going to be, you know, a celebration of, you know, Hunter S. Thompson's writing and life. And there's numerous panels that academic panels that connected with it. This year, where we are focusing on his political writing. I think it's timely to focus on his political writing with what's going on in the country. But We also have a panel on his Hunter S. Thompson as a sports writer. People who knew Hunter S. Thompson in life. And he, also Hunter S. Thompson's New York, because he spent some time in New York becoming a writer, you know, in the 50s, which is not really covered very much or known about. But there's also another side of Gonzo Fest, which is the poetry and music. I mean, it's almost like a type of Insomniacathon that, you know, another event that Ron and I did a lot of, which were, you know, stay up all night.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, that's where I remember the one down in New Orleans, because I think I was down there with Robert Creeley and Baraka, yeah. Actually. Okay. Yeah. Kent Feeling, this is Greg reconnecting. My guest today has been Kent Feeling, the author of River Church, Selected Poems, 1990 to 2025. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. This station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
WPFW presents Genius plus Soul equals Ray and John. Tuesday, September 23rd, 5 a.m. until midnight. This will be a fundraising birthday tribute like no other, illuminating the lives and contributions of Ray Charles and John Coltrane, two icons of American music. Schedule and details at WPFWFM.org, where you can also contribute anytime. WPFW, preserving the culture, one broadcast at a time.
Baltimore Book Festival takes place Saturday and Sunday, September 13th and 14th on the Waverly Main Street in central Baltimore. Now in its 29th year, this year's festival features talks by a wide variety of notable authors, including Zaina Azam, Charlie Jane Anders, Jeff Chang, and Tourmaline. And kicks off on Saturday at 10 a.m. with a special drag queen story hour focused on the life of transgender icon Marsha P. Johnson. Details on close to 100 author events across 8 stages and 6 city blocks, filled with vendors at BaltimoreBookFest.com.
WPFW, your station for jazz and justice, is seeking a leader to serve as WPFW's next general manager. We are looking for someone with strong managerial skills, a commitment to independent media, an appreciation for African American culture and history, and a passion for community service. The general manager will guide WPFW's mission, oversee an extraordinary group of staff and volunteers, and help build the future of this listener-supported community treasure. If you are ready to lead with creativity, integrity, and vision, we want to hear from you. To apply or learn more, visit hr@pacifica.org.
Hi, I'm Renee Bowser, a staunch trade unionist and host of a new WPFW program, Unionism Drives Community, airing Thursdays at 5 p.m. We will share the importance of knowing your rights in the workplace, the impact of unionism on working class advancement beyond the workplace, and how unionism can activate robust community among all of us. That's Unionism Drives Community, Thursdays at 5 p.m. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
What's it do if you're approached by the police?
We deserve to be safe in our neighborhoods.
Follow these tips to assert your rights.
If you're being stopped, detained, or arrested, the best thing to say is nothing.
Stick to only these questions. Am I free to go? If stopped by law enforcement, try to leave the conversation as quickly and safely as possible.
Ask, am I free to go?
If yes, walk away calmly and quietly. Running away could give them pretext to detain you. Officers may try an incite a reaction. Ignore them. Knowing your rights is a great first step.
And asserting your rights is even better.
WPFW family, the fun begins on Saturday, September 13th at the WPFW 5K Run Walk for Total Fitness from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. In addition to the 5K, fitness and wellness classes such as Tai Chi, line dancing, breath work, double dutch, and more will be offered along with music to fuel your participation. There is something for everyone to enjoy. This event takes place at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland. Details are available at wpfwfm.org or 202-888-5484. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The United Black Community presents the 21st annual Love Supreme, a musical, poetic birthday tribute to another Ruth, John Coltrane, featuring the Nasa Abaday Quintet, Cindy Brown,